Hope that everyone is having a meaningful fast. They have to remind themselves that the purpose of fast days in general, the Rambam writes that the purpose of fast days are the Rambam writes that it's supposed to stir the hearts in order to send us on a path of teshuvah. So we incorporate slichos into the fast days, and so hopefully the fasts will just act as a medium to guide us in a formal teshuva. So I wanted to discuss today in particular is the uniqueness of Tanis Esther. And then hopefully if we have time at the end, we'll also discuss the mitzvah of Mishloach Manos. These two Divrei Torah, first on Tanis Esther and then on Mishloach Manos, heard many times from my Rebbe Rav David Hirschlita, a good friend of the Rises. That Rav David Hirsch, my Rebbe, I learned by him for many years in Yeshiva University. I heard him say over this Shtigl Torah, this Dvar Torah many times. So we'll go through the entire presentation. So it begins as follows, where there's a unique aspect that we find by Tanis Esther that doesn't exist by other fast days, where it really presents itself in the following situation where the Gemara in Rosh Hashanah tells us that there was something called the Megillas Tanis. The Megillas Tanis, the Gemara tells us, was a collection of 54 minor holidays that the Jewish people used to observe. And they were related to a significant event of salvation, of Hashem's hand in helping the Jewish people on these particular days. And and it says in the Gemara that on these days of the Megillas Tanis, one is not supposed to have a fast day the day before or the day after these minor holidays. Of the 52 minor holidays, the only two that are still in effect is Hanukkah and Purim, the only two that are still in effect. Otherwise, but the Megillas Tanis, says the Gemara, the other minor holidays are no longer observed. So that the question becomes that Tanis Esther is the day before Purim. Purim is one of those minor holidays, if that's the case. So then today, the day before Purim, really, we should not be fasting. But Chazal instituted, our rabbis instituted a special fast day for this day, the day before this minor holiday of Purim. So the question is, what is that about? So this question is already raised by the Rishonim. The Ran brings up this question as one of the commentaries in the back of the Gemara. The Ran answers, he says that this really displays a qualitative difference between Tanis Esther and all other fast days. All other fast days are to commemorate a sense of mourning, right? To acknowledge a sense of mourning, to create an atmosphere of mourning, where, as we mentioned before, the Rambam, that fast days are supposed to encourage teshuva. And most of those are due to a mistake that Klal Yisrael had made, and then due to that, suffered tremendously, and a mistake that we have yet to rectify. And therefore, we need to do teshuva in order to rectify that mistake that we continue to make, whether it be related to sin aschinam, due to the destruction of the Beis HaMikdash, and the like. So therefore, we have a fast day in order to accomplish that. That is a standard fast day to commemorate the temple. However, says the Ran, that there could be another type of fast, where a person is not doing as a form of teshuva and commemoration of something negative. But rather, you could theoretically have a tanis, a fast that is of a that's rooted in something joyous. This is what the Ran says, and that he says is what tanis Esther is. Tanis Esther is, to borrow the language of the Hagos Hashri, is a Tanis shel simcha. It's a tanis, the lav paranusahu, that is not negative in its nature. It's not to commemorate something that was destructive. It's not to commemorate a sorrow of Klal Yisrael, but rather it is joyous in its nature. Now, there's a number of different explanations as to why it is that we have tanis Esther. Where did this tanis come from? Why is it that we fast? The Beis Yosef explains, the standard explanation is because when Esther told Mordechai to tell the Jews that we're going to have this 3-day fast. So at that point, Klal Yisrael took it upon themselves as a formal obligation they're going to do on a yearly basis. On the 13th of Adar, which is the day that the Jewish people were supposed to be eradicated by Haman. So on that day, we have this fast day. Okay, that is, and we know that we won, right? Which is why the fast is a Ta'anah Shel Simcha. It's a fast day that we've taken upon ourselves, but also as an element of Simcha associated with it because Haman didn't win. It's interesting. There's a couple other reasons that are found in the poskim. One of the reasons also brought down by the Beis Yosef is that we know that the next day, Purim, people can get caught up in the festivities of the day, and that can actually lead to, God forbid, mistakes happening, people maybe not treating each other necessarily the way that they're supposed to treat each other, people saying things that they maybe shouldn't have said. And because of that, Chazal want us to get ahead of it and have a fast day as kind of like a way of recentering ourselves before we get involved in the different festivities that one could get involved in. Anyway, bottom line is that the Hagos Ashri says, based on this, Ta'anis Esther is not a Ta'anis. It's not a fast to commemorate something negative, but rather it is qualitatively different. It's a Ta'anis Shel Simcha. That's why there's nothing wrong with having a fast day the day before Purim, because this isn't a negative fast day. This is a positive fast day to commemorate a simcha, a joy of the Jewish people being saved. This also relates to another interesting question. This is brought up by the Mordechai, which is also a commentary in the back of the Gemara. One of the great Rishonim, that the Mordechai, he explains, why is it that when it comes to Ta'anis Esther, we also schedule this fast day differently than we would schedule other fast days? What do I mean? Let's say Purim falls out on a Shabbos or a Sunday. Shabbos or Sunday. So when do we do Ta'anis Esther? We do Ta'anis Esther the Thursday before. We do Ta'anis Esther earlier. We do it a couple days before, before Purim. Now, what happens when Tisha B'Av falls out on a Shabbos? When do we observe Tisha B'Av? Sunday, the next day, right? Falls out on a any of the fast days fall out on a Friday or a Shabbos. We always push it off. By the way, why don't we fast on Fridays? So there's two interesting reasons why we don't fast on Fridays. If a Ta'anis falls out on a Friday, except the one exception of Asar B'Teves, there, because the Abu Dam writes, it's a special Gzeres HaKasav. It's a special exception to the rule that's given by the Navi. The Navi says, Be'etzem Hayom Hazeh, that it needs to be on this day. But that's only Asar B'Teves, that if it fell out on a Friday, we'd fast on a Friday. But all other fast days, falls out on a Friday, we don't fast on the Friday. Mishnah Berurah says, because a person's going to be so focused getting ready for Shabbos, they're not going to be able to give their proper attention to the fast. And the Aruch HaShulchan has the opposite explanation, that a person is going to be so focused on the fast that they're going to go into Shabbos Shlepi, and therefore they're not going to be able to enjoy Shabbos. So we don't fast on Fridays. Fine. But when would we fast if a fast fell out on a Friday or Shabbos? We push it off to Sunday. That's what we do. We push it off to Sunday. Why don't we say the same thing by Ta'anis Esther? That if Purim falls out on a Shabbos or a Sunday, we make Ta'anis Esther early on Friday. Why don't we, on Thursday rather, why don't we push it off till afterwards? So you have to understand why it is that we push off fast days generally. The reason we push off fast days generally is because the Gemara has this concept of Akdemuse Parunusa lo Makdeminum, that we don't want to bring tragedy upon ourselves earlier. That's what the Gemara says in Megillah on Daf Hey. We don't want to bring it upon ourselves earlier. We push it off. So we push off this commemoration of fasting Tisha B'Av. We're going to push it off till after Tisha B'Av. We don't want to have to bring it upon ourselves earlier. Megillah says the Ta'anis Esther, though, it's not Parnusa. It's not negative. And therefore, bringing it in earlier, it's not a problem. Because the Simcha Dikdei, it's a happy day. It's a happy day today. And therefore, nothing wrong with doing the fast day earlier, bringing it upon ourselves earlier. Fasting today is not a negative day. It's a positive day, which is why if it were to fall out, a permanent fallout on Shabbos or Sunday, we wouldn't push off the fast. We bring it upon ourselves earlier. We do it the Thursday before because it's a happy day. Another interesting practical implication of Tanis Esther being a day that's festive and happy in nature is the Rama. The Rama tells the Rama of Moshe Isserles, chief rabbi of Krakow, lived from 1530 to 1572. He was the counterpart of Rabbi Yosef Karo, the Shulchan Aruch, where he made his code of Jewish law, Rabbi Yosef Karo. After he made his code of Jewish law, you can really give a lot of credit to the Rama for making the Shulchan Aruch into a success, because what the Rama did was that he, instead of having his own Shulchan Aruch for the Ashkenaz community, he just made annotations to the Shulchan Aruch, basically saying that unless I'm going to comment, I agree with everything that you're saying, and then I'll just make some annotations where the Ashkenaz minhag differs a little bit, right? And so there is, so he really can be credited for making the Shulchan Aruch the success that it has been, is because he decided that this is going to be the book for everybody, Sephardim and Ashkenazim alike. So the Rama, unfortunately, he lived a very, very short life. He was about 40 years younger, a little bit more than 40 years younger than Rabbi Yosef Karo. The Rama, in his annotations on Shulchan Aruch, he points out that on Tanis Esther, if a person is not having an easy fast, we know generally speaking that we have to fast the fast days, right? Especially if we're talking about Yom Kippur, that's D'oraisa, that's a very, very serious situation. The only time a person would not fast Yom Kippur is if it was something life-threatening. The only time a person wouldn't fast Tisha B'Av would be if it's also something that is life-threatening. But the other fast days, a person could break their fast if it's gotten to a point that it's making the person sick. It's making the person sick, so then they would break their fast on the other minor fast days. The other fast days that commemorate the destruction of the temple: Shavasar B'Tammuz, the 17th of Tammuz, Asar B'Teves, Tzom Gedalia. So if a person gets sick, they break their fast. But really, a person should really try their best, even if it's difficult to fast. If it means you're going to stay in bed the whole day, better to make it through the fast. That is not the case, though, by Tanis Esther. Tanis Esther were much more lenient about breaking your fast. Now, of course, we have to fast. This is the obligation we have upon ourselves today. However, a person should not wait until they get themselves until they're sick. That even if a person starts to not feel well, a person is finding themselves not able to function properly, they technically have the right to break their fast at that point. This is the Rama writes. He says that if a person gets a bad headache or an eye ache, is what he writes, koave enayim, it's really just very uncomfortable by the fast, it's giving you a bad headache and something like that, Rama says you're able to break your fast at that point. Why are we so lenient on it? The answer, suggested Hirsch, is because this is called a tanishal simcha. If it's going to detract from the simcha of the yom, so then even if you just have koave enayim, even if it's just an eye ache, a bad headache, something along those lines, so there's more room to be lenient in breaking your fast, because qualitatively today is a tinus shel simcha. Rav Shechter Shlita, Rav Hirschel Shechter Shlita, our great Rebbe, one of the post gador, he also points out an interesting application of this concept that Tanis Esther is a joyous day. He discusses the obligation of chinuch, where we know that we have a concept of experiential education in Judaism, where not experiential, the children should experience the, not experimental, that's the way that it came out, sounded that way. No, experiential. They should experience all the Torah mitzvahs before they become obligated formally at the age of 12 or 13 years old for a girl or a boy. The obligation of chinuch rests upon the parents, and the Gemara and Sukkah on Mem Beis goes through when it is that they should start training the child. Like when a child begins to speak, they should train the child to learn the Psukim of Shema Yisrael and Torah Tzivalon Moshe. When the child begins to know how to wave something, so the Gemara says you should teach it how to teach the child how to take lulav and esrog, right? Not right away put a baseball bat in its hand, put a lulav and esrog in its hand and start teaching the child to take lulav and esrog. As the Gemara goes through all of the different steps of chinuch. So when it comes to, though, the mitzvah of avelus, We don't have chinuch ba'avelus. Says the Gemara in Mo'ikatan, ain chinuch ba'avelus. That if, let's say, God forbid a million times, a child loses one of their seven close relatives, the child would not observe the laws of Shiva. If they want to, they could do whatever they want. But there is no laws, the formal laws of Shiva, Shloshim, and Yud Beis Chodesh of the set of the week of the passing, the 30-day mark, and the first month after the passing, and the year of mourning would not apply to a child. They treat it as they want to, as a relatively quote unquote normal year for themselves, at least in a halachic framework. The reason, by the way, it's interesting, is pointed out by the Sefer Beis Hillel, a classic sefer on the laws of Avelus in Yaradea. So the Beis Hillel explains, he says, based on what we said before, what's the whole purpose of what's the whole purpose of the different practices of Avelus? The purpose of the different practices of Avelus, just like fasting, is the Rambam writes the very, very similar language. He says, is that it's a mandated reflection period in order, l'ftoach darkei teshuva, the Rambam uses the same language, to set a person on the path of teshuva. So all the details of the laws of Shiva, Shloshim, the year of mourning, all of those details, those laws, are to help create a framework for a person to set them on a guide for teshuva. So therefore, says the Beis Hillel, children never did anything in their life that they would have to be accountable for. They are not obligated in teshuva. Now, we train the children in teshuva, but these aspects of, like, we bring it to shul and on Yom Kippur and the like, but in terms of avelos, they never did anything that they would have to do teshuva for, because they're not held accountable yet for mistakes that they may have made, because they're not bar bar mitzvah yet. And therefore, the concept of chinuch does not apply to avelos. So therefore, when it comes to other fast days, children are not obligated to fast their fast days. Yom Kippur, we train them to do a year in advance that they fast Yom Kippur. Other fast days, though, there's no technical obligation for children. Now, it's a good idea either way to train the kids, just because we know that they're going to end up having to be obligated in this. So, when a child reaches a certain age of maturity, they understand what the day's about. All right, you recommend to them that they have, you know, one less snack that day. Maybe they skip breakfast, something, right? But there's definitely no formal obligation of chinuch for children when it comes to fast days. When it comes to Tanis, the fast day that we're observing today, being that it's a Tanis Shal Simcha, said Rav Shechter, today's not a sad day. It's not a form of avelus. And they're right, we're not commemorating the destruction of the Beis HaMikdash. So the concept of ein chinuch ba'avelus, if we don't educate children in tragedy, doesn't apply today. And therefore, children, again, as long as it's healthy, for the child to start taking on some practices of fasting today is not a bad idea. So when the child is old enough, 9, 10, 11 years old, you start training them to fast half a day on Tanis Esther, eventually move to a full day, because today is not a sad day. Today is a happy day. And therefore, it would not fall into the regular rules of not training children in Avelos. It's interesting. This, the way that Rav Shechter just applied this general presentation we're giving of that Tanis Esther is a happy day, up until now, we've been treating that as a leniency. Rav Shechter just found a chumrah as well, that in the stringent realm, that we're being machmer. We're saying that being that it's a tanishal simcha, yes, there's leniencies, but also we train children in this day as well, because it's a tanishal simcha. Another application, or Rebbe of David Hirsch, wanted to say that we have a chumrah that applies, a stringency that applies by other fast days, of that we know that on Tisha B'Av and Yom Kippur, there's five inuim. There's five things that we do to refrain, that we refrain from, in order to feel the day more, in order to feel the burden more of the day. So we, for example, not only do we not eat on Yom Kippur and Tisha B'Av, but we also don't bathe and anoint ourselves and all those laws of Tisha B'Av and Yom Kippur. There is a comment of the Magen Avram, he quotes from the Shlah, that the Magen Avram quotes from the Shlah that the other fast days is a good chumrah to have. It's a good stringency to have that you take upon yourself these other practices on the other fast days. For example, not brushing your teeth, taking a shower, anointing oneself, also not a bad idea to do for the other fast days. However, Tanis Esther, it wouldn't make any sense because today is a Tanis Shel Simcha. Adding on more inuim, this is what we first wanted to say, adding on more more things that are going to make the day more difficult upon ourselves in Tanis Esther may be counter to the day, right? We're fasting because that's the custom that was created by Esther and Mordechai on this day of Yud Gimel Adar, that we also are trying to, maybe we're trying to get ahead of the festivities of Purim, whatever it is. But in its nature, today is a happy day. And therefore, adding upon ourselves things that are beyond the letter of the law, unnecessary to do, that maybe we would do by other fast days, today we wouldn't add on other stringencies unnecessarily. Another practical implication of this is that let's say there's a bris milah today. Actually, there's a bris milah of a member of the shul today, not here in Queens. Is the bris of the Freifeld grandson was today in Queens. So the question is discussed in the postgame about we know that that by a bris after the bris there's a whole suda smitzah, a whole elaborate meal that takes place. There is, though, and this is cited in by Tosos and Masechta Shabbos on Daf Kuf Lamed, that for the Moel, the Sandik, and the Aviya Ben, and the father of the child, there is an obligation to have a Seuda, to have an appropriate meal today. That's why Rav Schechter was always mocked, but he always felt that it's a real obligatory meal, so you should have meat and wine at a bris milah. Now, most shuls they go for the bagel cream cheese lox route, not necessarily the fleishig route. But if you go to a bris in Yeshiva University, that's a student of Rav Schechter, you have a pretty good track record of going to have a deli sandwich at 8 o'clock in the morning. That's so because it's a real sudas mitzvah. So. And my cousin just recently had a baby, and they had the bagel and cream cheese and lox, he himself he got himself a little table just for himself, and he had himself a real suuda of meat and wine. It's a real suuda. So the question becomes a bris milah on Tanis Esther. So what do you do? It's a other fast day. Okay, so you have the suuda later, right? What about on Tanis Esther? Tanis Esther, Vavad Yosef in the Echavedas says, of course, everybody else wouldn't be able to eat because there's no obligatory festive meal for them, but for the father, the Sandik, and for the Moel, they would have the ability to have a Seuda, to have their meal, even on Tanis Esther. Again, because it's a Tanis Shel Simcha. It's a fast day of joy. Is what he writes in the Echavedas. Interesting, the Echavedas, written by Rav Avadia Yosef, was a radio show that he used to have. It was like a Q&A session with the chief rabbi on the Israeli radio that later he recorded all of those broadcasts into a 6-volume work, the Echavedas, his response of that someone would call in with a question. He gave him a whole elaborate question on the spot. Rav Avadia Yosef was an absolute genius. And they recorded those responses later in the Echavedas. So that's where he writes. He got this question in the radio show, and he recorded this response that there'd be nothing wrong with the father and the Sandik and the Moel having their Su'uda on Tanis Esther, because today is qualitatively different. Today is a joyous day. Rav Zsolti points out something really interesting, that Rav Bezalel Zsolti was the former chief rabbi of Yerushalayim, was an incredible Talmud Chacham. He was a student of the Chevron Yeshiva, and his Sfarim, the Mishnah Siyavitz, are celebrated set of works. It's a 3-volume set that are absolutely delicious, Divrei Torah. It happens to be that Rav Hirsch, my Rebbe, is his, almost one of, I think it's his favorite sefer, one of his favorite sfarim is the Mishnah Seyavetz. If you look at his 3-volume work of the Mishnah Seyavetz that's owned by Rav Hirsch, half the pages are missing because he's gone through it so many times that it's totally ripped to shreds at this point. It's an amazing work. So Rav Zsolti, Rav Bezalel Zsolti, he points out a Rambam that seems to agree with this as well. That this presentation that we're giving, that Tanis Esther is a day of Simcha, where Rav Zsolti points to the Rambam at the very end of Hilchos Megillah, the very end of the Laws of Purim. The Rambam writes that Kol Sifrei HaNeviim V'Kol HaKesuvim, that all of the mandates that we find in the Navi and in the rest of Tanakh and the writings as well, Asidin Li'Batel, are not going to be observed formally anymore when Mashiach comes. Those mandates that we find in those Sfarim are not going to be observed. Why that is that the Rambam writes that is a whole discussion of itself. We'll probably have to get to it on Wednesday nights. Normally we do this week? Are we on this week? We should be on this week, right? Yeah, we should be, right? Yeah.
Right? For personal reasons, many people come.
Okay, fine. But we're on this week, right? Yeah, we should be on this week, right? Perm's tomorrow. Tomorrow's Tuesday, right? Okay. Wednesday, right? Today's Tanis Esther. Tomorrow's Perm, right? Yeah, we should be on Wednesday, right, Jack? Okay, well, you're in charge though. So Wednesday nights we've been going through this series of what are the days of Mashiach going to look like? We're now, what number of class are we up to now already at this point?
Yeah,
I think we've done maybe more than 10 at this point. So we have to get to this question about what the Rambam means when he writes this, that all the books of Tanakh are going to, not Tanakh, just Nach, the Vim and Ksuvim, are going to be null and void once Mashiach comes. What exactly he means by that? Because the Rav already on the spot says, no clue what the Rambam's talking about or where he's coming from when he writes this. But anyway, take that for what it is. Take that at face value for now. He says, however, Chutz Megillas Esther. Megillas Esther is not going to be batel. The mandates of Megillas Esther, meaning the laws of Purim, are still going to be in effect once Mashiach comes. Still going to be in effect. We're still going to be giving Shalach Manos, Matanos Levyonim. We're going to have the Seuda, reading the Megillah. These halachos are still going to be in effect after Mashiach comes. Hari Kayamis Kechamisha Chum Shei Torah. It's treated just like the 5 books of the Torah. The Kehilcho Kehalacho Shel Torah Shebaal Peh, as the status of Torah Shebaal Peh of the oral tradition, which of course is also Doraisa, Shein and Betelim the Olam, that are observed forever. But then he continues and he says, he says, quotes this from a pasuk, and he says that Yemei Hapurim Lo Yivatu, the days of Purim are not going to become null and void. Now, what does he mean by the days of Purim, days of Purim? So Rav Zsolti is saying, well, hold on 1 second. Purim is only one day. Now, there's 2 different days that Purim is observed. Purim is observed outside of Yerushalayim, or outside of the walled cities from Yeshua ben Nun, which we only know for sure as being Yerushalayim. So outside of Yerushalayim, it's observed on the 14th. And then in Yerushalayim, it's on the 15th. But that's the same day. It's the day of Purim. It's just observed on 2 different days. So what does he mean when he says the days, which is coming to include more than just the day of Purim? Yemei HaPurim, suggested Rav Zsolti, and he proves this from other places as well. Rabbeinu Tam, in the beginning of Masechta Megillah, seems to suggest the same thing, is that it's referring to Tanis Esther. Tanis Esther is a day of Simcha like Purim. We just approach it in a different way, right? The day of Tanis Esther is a day of Simcha that we have with the fact that Jewish people were saved, and now Hashem has given us this day of a Tanis that we can do for Teshuvah. But it's in its nature, it's a day of Simcha as opposed to the other fast days. So this is again. We just point out a number of different examples. I'll give you one more example of where you find that Tanis Esther is really a Tanis Shel Simcha. It's really a joyous day. Another practical implication is what are you allowed to break your fast on? We know the halacha is by other fast days that you're not supposed to break your fast on flasics, right? Shvasar batamos during the 3 weeks, right? At the end of that fast, you don't break the fast on flasics. You have milchics. During the motzei asar b'teves, you don't have, when the fast is over, you don't have flasics, you also have milchics. Because it's jarring, explains the Mishnah Berurah, that what you're going to, right after you commemorate the destruction of the temple, you're going to start eating meat, drinking wine. It's just like, it's counter to, like, we missed the point, right? It's like similar to what the Aruch HaShulchan writes as to why we don't eat meat during the 9 days, is because we can't bring karbanos in the Beis HaMikdash anymore. So we're gonna eat meat. It's just, it's so not fitting within the spirit of the day. So on the, when the fast concludes, by the other fast days, we don't break it with meat. Rav Hirsch said, but Tanis Esther, even if it doesn't lead directly into Purim, right? Sometimes Purim is a couple days later, right? If it falls out on a Sunday, right? We do Tanis Esther, as we said before. Tanis Esther is Thursday, and then Purim is going to be Sunday. So it's not leading right into Purim. So, but even then, you'd be allowed to have fleishiks to break your fast with on Tanis Esther. I don't know whether or not that's the right thing to do, medically speaking. Ask the doctors in the room. They know better than me, right? Probably not the best idea. Okay, doctors are saying don't do it. Okay, that's Shabbos. That you have a Shabbos obligation. What?
I mean, except obviously for 7 days, but.
Yeah, the other fast, you're not supposed to have flasics. Yeah, by the other fast days. Yeah. Right. But yeah, yeah. No, but yeah, sure. That's the halacha. No, No. We don't break our fast on flasics. But Tanis Esther, you would be able to. Now, of course, it's Purim tonight, right? So either way, you'd be able to because it's Purim. But even if it wasn't Purim tonight, let's say Purim was in a couple days, Tanis Esther, the end of Tanis Esther, you're allowed to have flasics again because today's not a commemoration of the discussion of the Beis HaMikdash. It's a happy day. And therefore, Rav Hirsch said there would be nothing wrong with having flasics to break your fast of Tanis Esther. Again, as we mentioned before, what makes today a happy day is because today is not a commemoration of a destruction. Baruch Hashem, there wasn't a destruction, right? Thank God. You know, it's a funny imagery that happens. I've noticed in the past, but I always find it to be a funny imagery that when we hear Haman's name, right? So we start screaming like, boo, right? And shaking our groggers, right? And then you have every once in a while, you have the guy that brings, you know, the bullhorn, right? And you have the guy that brings the big, noisemaker, right? It makes like a cow sounds from their phone, right? And it becomes a whole funny shtick when you hear Haman's name. So I find the imagery of that to be, now sometimes it can get out of hand, but the imagery of like making a joke when we hear Haman's name actually on one hand kind of makes sense, because thank God we can joke about it because nothing happened. We weren't destroyed. HaKadosh Baruch Hu saved the day, right? Today we're fasting because Esther and Mordechai told all the Jews, Lekos, Nukola Yehudim, and we're going to make 3 fast days because we need to invoke Hashem's Rachamim to save the Jewish people during this time where we could be destroyed, but we weren't destroyed. So we fast today to remind ourselves that HaKadosh Baruch Hu is always going to answer our tefillos. So the Rambam writes, is that's the ultimate message of Purim, that HaKadosh Baruch Hu always answers the tefillos of Klal Yisrael. So today is that reminder. It's a very, very happy day. HaKadosh Baruch Hu, this is a fast day that our ancestors fasted and it worked. And so we can fast and it can work too. And so therefore, by nature, it's a very happy day. I want to just move on. That's right. Right. Being that, right. That's what makes it. Absolutely. Yes, that's right. Absolutely. Absolutely. And then it's based on that same principle, based on that Gemara we mentioned on Shabbos, that Rav Masa said the ultimate lesson of Purim is that tefillah works. That tefillah works. We see that that's what happened in the Purim story as well. Yeah, Dee.
So you mentioned at the very beginning there were 2 fasts of Simcha that were left out of the 52.
Two holidays of Simcha. So the 2 holidays is Purim and Hanukkah. And that those 52 days were all minor holidays that you can't fast the day before or after. So the issue is that Purim, we do fast the day before, right? Even though it's a minor holiday, we fast the day before. That's because it's not a negative fast day. It's a happy fast day.
But the fast of Simcha fast, Tammuz Esther, is also the only fast that is not a standalone fast. Like, Tisha B'Av is a standalone fast on the day of Tisha B'Av.
Oh, interesting. It's grouped to another day. Well, no, but in terms of the formal fast days, yeah. In terms of the formal fast days, yes, right? But yeah, Michael's making a good point, right? That's a customary fast day that is grouped with the holiday of Pesach. But in terms of the formalized fast days, that is true. It's the only one that's grouped with it. That was like what Rav Zsolti was pointing out from the Rambam, that the Rambam refers to these days as the days of Purim, meaning Tanis Esther, and then the festivities of Purim itself. Yeah, yeah. Okay, let's move on now. With the few minutes we have remaining, we'll move on to the mitzvah of Mishloach Manos. Mitzvah of Mishloach Manos is always one of the hallmarks of Purim, of that people are going around and delivering gifts and baskets to one another. And it's important for us to understand the mechanism of this mitzvah of Mishloach Manos, that we give two separate gifts, a food or drink, to one another. The Trumas Hadeshen writes in his Jews, Trumas Hadeshen, Rav Yisrael Moshe Isserlin, I believe he passed away in 1425, was a halachist in Ashkenaz Jewry that really sat at the edge between the Rishonim and the Achronim. Like, he really created the line of where the Rishonim ended and where the Achronim, the later commentators in the Ashkenaz world, continued, because the Trumas Hadeshen really wears both hats. He lived during the times of Rishonim, but so much of his writing is like an Achron. What's the difference between a Rishon and an Achron? Just in general, it's important to know this. A Rishon, when someone says the Rishonim say, who are the Rishonim? The Rishonim is any great Torah scholar who is either making a commentary on an original source on his own, meaning not taking into account the other commentary that has been given, or coming to a halachic decision based off of their own understanding of the Torah or the Gemara or the previous traditions, without taking into account what the other rabbis, what his contemporaries have to say on the matter. That is what a Rishon is, which is why you'll find Rishonim that will argue on each other, because it doesn't matter that the other one said this. I have a different interpretation based off of my tradition, that this is the way to interpret the Gemara. So they're speaking, I wouldn't say in a vacuum, but they're speaking with their own sense of authority. An Achron, though, is not talking with their own sense of authority. What they're doing is that they are saying, listen, I've analyzed not only the original source, but I've analyzed it according to all the different opinions. And based off of my analysis, and based off of looking at the different ways of reading this, I think that the most correct approach is to do the following. So they're taking into account everything that came before them, including the non-authoritative rabbis that came before them, like the Rishonim previously. So that is what an Achron is. He's coming to his decision based not only on the original tradition of the Talmud, but including what the original commentators, the Rishonim, had to say for themselves. The Trumas Hadeshen was living in both of those worlds, because he was living at a time of all the Rishonim, but the way he writes, he takes into account what the Rush has to say and what the Rambam has to say. And so he's quoting all of people that are quote unquote contemporaries of his. So he's writing like an Achron, but living during the times of Rishonim. Very unique character. Unique for other reasons as well, but we'll leave that for now. So the Trumas Hadeshen was sent a question, or he composed the question, where the question was, can you, instead of sending food for Mishloach Manos, can you send, another type of a gift? You know that a friend of yours is in need of a toaster oven. Can you give them a toaster oven? You know that a friend of yours is in need of, I think he was talking about clothing, need of certain clothing or whatever it might be. And I give them that instead of the food. Do I fulfill my mitzvah Mishloach Manos? Trumas Hadeshen says, no, I do not. And the reason is because, and this is what this is the key. He says, because the whole purpose of Mishloach Manu is to facilitate food for each other's su'udah. We're going to have we have an obligation of having the su'udas parim. And therefore, we need to make sure that we're all taken care of. In fact, the Gemara Megillah on Daf Zion talks about how the Amoraim used to swap Purim su'udas. They used to do like a potluck Purim su'udah, where they would either bring food to each other, or they'd have each other over to each other's houses year after year. And in that way, you're also fulfilling not only the mitzvah of su'udah, but also Mishloach Manos, right? I'm giving you food to facilitate your su'udah, facilitate your festive meal you're going to be having on Purim. That, says the Truma Sedition, is the purpose of Mishloach Manos. However, Shlomo Levi Alkabetz, we mentioned on Shabbos, he points out that Mishloach Manos, really in its core, is that the rabbis wanted to obligate us to create camaraderie amongst Klal Yisrael. And therefore, many assume that according to the Manos HaLevi, there'd be nothing wrong with giving inedible food, stuff to one another, to give each other different items, give each other clothing or appliances or whatever would make somebody happy, to create camaraderie amongst Klal Yisrael. And those are really the two different approaches to Mishloach Manos. Now, we should mention that the Rugachever, Yosef Rosen, whose Yortzeit was just a couple days ago, the Rugachever Gaon, one of the greatest geniuses to live in the last couple hundred years, the Rugachever points out they once asked the Meshech Chachma, who was extremely close to the Rugachever, they're very, very close friends, how is it that the Rugachever never forgets anything? He mamish, he knew everything at his fingertips. They say once that the Rugachever commented, he said that he didn't forget a single moment of his life since he was 3 years old. Like, I'm talking about somebody who had...
That's
going to
be a burden.
Yeah, could be potentially, yeah. The Rugachever was an amazing mind. He was like something from another world. So, they once asked the Meshech Chachma, how is it that the Rugachever has such an amazing memory? I never forget anything in learning. And the response that the Meshech Chachma gave, of the Or Sameach, Rav Meir Simcha Levinsk, he responded and he said, there's a lot of great Gaonim that have good memories that don't forget anything. So that's not what's impressive about the Rugachever's mind. It's not that he doesn't forget. It's that by the Rugachever, that's gelernt. It's that it's as if he's learning it right now. That's how clear it is to him. That's something he learned 30 years earlier. It's as if he's learning it right now. That's how clear it is to him. That's the type of mind we're talking about. So he has a responsa about Mishloach Manos, and he says that the mitzvos of Purim, being that they were canonized in Tanakh, we have to treat them like a deoraisa. We have to treat them like they're a mitzvah from the Torah. Now, what kind of practical implication does that make? It makes a practical implication for us in the realm of a suffix, of a doubt. Meaning that if I'm unsure how to fulfill this mitzvah, I need to be machmer. I need to take a more stringent approach, because we have a general rule of suffix d'oraisa, l'chumra, that in scenarios of doubt, when it comes to how to fulfill biblical mitzvot, I need to be stringent about it. I need to be machmer about it. Suffix d'oraisa, l'chumra. Fine. So if that's the case, we're going to now go through different scenarios that can come up by Mishloach Manos. And we're going to see that depending if you take the approach of the Trumas Hadeshen or of the Manos HaLevi, aka is the purpose of Mishloach Manos in order to facilitate food for each other, su'udah, or is the purpose of Mishloach Manos to create camaraderie amongst Klai. So we'll go through different scenarios. We're going to see that those two approaches are going to come out on two different sides of each of these scenarios. Bottom line, though, is that we try and be machmir. We try to be stringent about all of these questions, because the Rugachever writes, being that these mitzvot were canonized in Tanakh, Mishloach Manos was canonized in Tanakh, therefore, we have to be stringent about these matters. Let's go through one at a time. As we mentioned before, food versus inedible items. So we're machmer, like the Trumas Hadeshen, we should make sure to give food to one another. Number two is the Rama. The Rama writes the following. He writes that by Mishloach Manos, let's say, Im Shaloach Manos L'Reihu, if I send gifts to my friend, who ain't a rotzi l'kablo. Let's say he doesn't want to accept them, right? I show up at somebody's house, and I made them a basket, and I open the door, and mamish, they got so many mishlachmanos, they open the door, they're like, literally, there's candy and hamantashen, like rolling out of the door. They got so much already. They're filled to the brim. So I'm going to give them mishlachmanos. They look at me, they're like, I love you. I so appreciate it. But like, Pesach's coming in like a month. Like, less than a month, all this stuff's got to be out of my house, right? This, by the way, if we're trying to take the lessons of Purim, of Mesiras Nefesh, of Esther Hamalka, right? The fact that Chazal instituted Mishloach Manos just less than a month before Purim shows real Mesiras Nefesh of Klal Yisrael for the mitzvah of Bedikas and Bir Chametz, of getting rid of all the Chametz in our house. We're willing to bring in mamish, like dozens of Hamantashen and all the other treats into our house less than a month before, because we are so Moser Nefesh for Hashem's mitzvahs. Anyway, so I'm probably over. I bring in the stuff. He asks, "Just really, I really don't need anything." And he says that I and he wrote to the Kabbalim. He doesn't want to accept them, and he doesn't take my Mishloach Manos. He's very appreciative. He loves it. He really, really is so like taken by the gesture. I can't take. Please give them to somebody else, or keep them for yourself. Have I just fulfilled my mitzvah of Mishloach Manos? So let's plug it in before we see the Ramah's answer. D says yes. Why?
Because
I've created the camaraderie, right? If the whole purpose of Mishloach Manos is to build camaraderie amongst Klal Yisrael, I just did. Okay. But according to the Trumas Hadeshin, what's the purpose of Mishloach Manos? To facilitate food for the Suda. I didn't add any food to his meal. Now, it could be he has enough anyway. But I still did not fulfill my mitzvah of facilitating.
If you come to someone's house and
I'm not excited, don't leave it here. Don't leave it here.
You go to someone's house.
And do I have a right to leave it at somebody's house?
But I'm saying, if you go to someone's house, you ring your bell, they don't answer.
Okay.
No,
but let's say I had that encounter and the guy says, take it with you. Doesn't want it. So let's see the Ramah. The Ramah says, what's the punchline? Mochalo. I don't need it. Yatsa. Fulfills his obligation. Fulfills his obligation. Because I created camaraderie amongst Paisar. Now, take the approach of the Truma Sedeshin, he would argue on it and say, but I didn't add anything to his Suda. Yeah, it could be that it's on him that I didn't, but bottom line, I didn't. And therefore, according to the Truma Sedeshin, I would not fulfill my obligation that way. According to the Monosalevi, I do. I do fulfill my obligation. Let's give another one. Another one would be, oh, this is interesting. There's a Tshuva of Chassam Sofer. Heard of Hirsch quote this Tshuva of Chassam Sofer before, that he, Chassam Sofer says, can I send Shalach Manos anonymously? Anonymously, right? I leave a package, a beautiful package at somebody's door, right? I'm trying to be a humble person, whatever, okay? For some reason I decide to do it anonymously. Or let's say inadvertently I did it anonymously, all right? Forgot to, I get home after living in Shalach Manos, I get home, sitting on the table are all of the family cards that everybody makes for themselves to put on the show. And he left, oh, I forgot to attach them to the show. Nobody even knows that we brought them over. Did I fulfill my mitzvah of Mishloach Manos? Let's plug it in. So if you take the approach that it's to facilitate food, did I facilitate food for my fellow Suda? I did, right? But did I create more camaraderie? Not really, meaning the person just got another basket of food. They don't know where it came from. Maybe it was, or assuming it was somebody from Klal Yisrael, maybe it wasn't, right? We don't even know where this came from. I don't know who to thank. I don't know who to pay it forward to, right? There's something lacking in the camaraderie. And therefore,
then you don't want to say who it's from because you don't want to potentially embarrass them. So you leave it anonymously so that that person accepted it from you and they felt embarrassed.
They felt like they'd have to pay it back or something, right? Okay, it could be. Here, though, we're talking about like the general atmosphere of the day. Is everyone bringing gifts over to each other's house, right? Right, Matanos Levyonim, for sure. Matanos Levyonim, I always just leave it anonymously by somebody's, in somebody's mailbox. They don't even know where it, came from, how it got there. I mean, I'm sure they can piece it together simply like, why else did I get this envelope of cash on Purim? But, you do it in a discreet fashion to hopefully try and, you know, save some dignity. And but Mishloach Monos, right? Everybody's just sending gifts to one another, the baskets, right? People want to be able to call up and say, "Oh, thank you so much. I appreciate it." So it if the purpose is to build more of that camaraderie, you would assume, says the, and this is what Chassam Sofer talks out. Chassam Sofer, by the way, was the son of the Chassam Sofer. Rav Moshe Sofer was the chief rabbi in Petersburg and the Oberlander region in Slovakia and Hungary in the 18th century, early 19th century, late 18th century. So here again, plugging it into this this framework, if you approach it as that it's to facilitate food, so then I did facilitate food, but if it's to create camaraderie, there's something lacking in the camaraderie. This is also an interesting question of that. Let's say a person has a special diet. For example, my son has a peanut allergy, peanut and sesame allergy. Let's say somebody drops off at our at his house, God willing. He has his own house, God willing, one day. And somebody drops off at his house a beautifully packaged peanut and hummus, shalach manas, right? Reese's and Sabra themed shalach manas dropped off at his house. Did they fulfill the mitzvah of mishloach manos? They fulfill mitzvah of mishloach manos. Again, if you take the approach to facilitate food for the seuda, I can't use this stuff, right? I'm not rejecting it, meaning I appreciate the fact that you brought it over, right? I'll give it away to somebody later. Like I'll give it to a coworker when I get back to work the next day or something like that. But I'm definitely not able to facilitate food for my seuda. I'm allergic to this stuff. But if you take the approach to create camaraderie, definitely camaraderie was created. Yeah. 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 Right. Exactly. Which is why if you take the approach of the Manos Halevi to create camaraderie, you're going to fulfill your mitzvah. But according to the Truma Sedeshin, that it's to facilitate more food for the Seuda, that's not going to no more food was added to my Seuda. Right. Theoretically. Yeah. Theoretically. This is a really interesting practical implication. The Gemara in Kiddushin has a discussion about that. Let's say we know that under under the chuppah, we know that the way that Kiddushin is made, that the first part of the marriage ceremony happens, is that the transaction takes place of the chasan giving the kala a ring, right? And the way that the Rishonim explained that is that the chasan is giving her kesev, which is a din d'oraisa, and that she gets hana, she gets a pleasure from that kesev of receiving that. The Gemara has a discussion of what can it happen in the opposite way, where let's say the kala is just so thrilled over the fact that she gets to marry this guy, the best guy around. Okay, everybody is a little bit nervous when they're under the chuppah. You never know who could be. Okay, but this guy though is like he's much better than like he's the best. He's the best. He's gonna be the next Gadol Hador. He's a tzaddik. He's a like perfect. Couldn't imagine anything better, right? And so she, instead of accepting a ring, she wants to give the ring or give kesef or give something, and that she is going to just feel a sense of like this incredible hana of this enjoyment over the fact that she gave her soon to be husband this gift. Does that work for the marriage ceremony? Now, the Gemara over there learns that we don't do that. Okay. It's not what we do practically. But let's plug it into Mishloach Manos. Okay. When it comes to Mishloach Manos, let's say on my route of the Mishloach Manos is I'm going to be stopping by one of the Gedolei Ador to give them Mishloach Manos, right? Or this incredible tzadekes, right? That I want to give them a Mishloach Manos. My wife wants to give her a Mishloach Manos, something, right? By them accepting that Mishloach Manos. If I showed up by Rav Schechter and gave him Mishloach Manos, and he said, wow, I so appreciate it. The way I would feel after that, I feel amazing after that. Did Rav Schechter, by accepting my Mishloach Manos, did he fulfill his mitzvah of Mishloach Manos by accepting him? Now again, right? If you take the approach of camaraderie, meaning he just made me feel so good, right? By just simply accepting my Mishloach Manos, he made me feel so good. So maybe he paid it back right away at that point. He doesn't actually have to give me anything, because by simply accepting it, the camaraderie was created. That sense of goodness, my sense of my self-esteem went up because of that. But if you take the approach to facilitate food, you can't eat self-esteem. And therefore, you wouldn't fulfill your mitzvah. Okay. Right, but he wouldn't fulfill his mitzvah. Right? It's the opposite. Right? It's, you have to think about it in the counter. Yeah. And this also relates to an interesting question, which is, why is there no bracha on Mishloach Manos? Why is there no bracha? Oh, the Rebbe's in it. Why is there no bracha on Mishloach Manos? So this is an interesting discussion about why there are no brachos on certain mitzvos in general. There's actually a tshuva of the Rashba. Chelek Aleph Simen Yud Ches, the fascinating tshuva of the Rashba, where he goes through mitzvah by mitzvah, why there's no, of mitzvos that don't have a bracha, why is there no bracha on those mitzvot? For example, why is there no bracha on the mitzvah of tzedakah? Why is there no bracha on the mitzvah of returning returning something that was stolen? Why is there no mitzvah? Why is there no bracha on the mitzvah of giving a get? You know, it's a mitzvah in the Torah. God forbid somebody is in that situation. It's a mitzvah in the Torah to do so. Right? You run into horrible situations of husbands that are recalcitrant and do not give a get. Aside from the fact that they're a rasha for doing that, they're also not fulfilling a mitzvah from the Torah that they have an obligation to do of giving the get. Why is there no bracha for these mitzvot? So the Rashba goes through every single one. Why not? For the mitzvah of tzedakah, he says, because the ani, similar to what Dee was saying, that maybe they won't accept it because maybe it's embarrassing to them, whatever it is. Maybe they won't accept the charity. And so if I'm going to, right before I give the charity, I'm going to make a bracha on the charity I'm about to give, on the tzedakah I'm about to give. What if they don't accept it? And then I didn't fulfill my mitzvah, right? Did I have intention to do a good thing? Yes. Does Hashem like that? Yes, of course. Did I fulfill the technical mitzvah of tzedakah? No. And therefore, no bracha should be made in case the tzedakah is rejected. And therefore, I did not fulfill the mitzvah, and the blessing would be made in vain. According to the Rama, though, if somebody did not accept my Mishloach Manos, did I still fulfill my mitzvah? We saw before, yes, right? Again, we said it's dependent on these two approaches, right? According to the Manos Levi, that makes sense, the built camaraderie. According to the Truma Sedeshin, he would say you don't fulfill your mitzvah because you didn't facilitate any food. But according to the Rama, why is there no bracha on Mishloach Manos, on suddenly gifts? If you're going to say, because the person might not accept it, like the Rashba says about tzedakah, so then that's not going to be a good enough answer. Because even if the person didn't accept it, I still fulfill my mitzvah. So you're going to have to come up with some other explanation as to why there's no bracha Mishloach Manos. So you can give a couple of different answers. One is that if you take the approach of the Manos Halevi, that's the built camaraderie, and that's what the Rama is saying, that's why you fulfill the mitzvah, even if they reject it, they don't accept it, I still fulfill the mitzvah because I built camaraderie. So eyes wise and obracha. So you could say, because according to the Manos Halevi, that it's to build camaraderie, in essence, the mitzvah is not really so actionable. It's really something that is more emotional. So whether or not emotionally the mitzvah, whether or not emotionally there's more camaraderie built amongst guys, right? That was really the intention of the rabbis when they created this mitzvah Mishloach Manos, is to build this emotional connection amongst members of Klal Yisrael. And so then if that's the case, so then this relates to a general principle we have in Brachos of that dvarim shebelev, that matters of the heart, do not require a bracha. For example, bitul chametz, nullifying chametz, right? We have we make a bracha on biur chametz, on destroying chametz. There's no bracha, though, the Beis Yosef explains, there's no bracha of bitul chametz, of nullifying chametz. Why not? Because that's in the heart, right? Unilaterally, I'm just getting rid of my chametz, and I'm just relinquishing my ownership over it. There's nothing really actionable there. And therefore, you can't make a bracha associated around something that is inactionable. So therefore, you have to say something like that for the Manos HaLevi as well. The reason why there's no bracha from Shoach Manos, even though I can fulfill the mitzvah, even if they don't accept it, still there's no bracha because it's something that's more emotional. Rav Hirsch wanted to say another answer where he said based off of the Rambam. The Rambam writes in Hilchos Brachos, I believe it's in Perek Yud Beis Hilchos Brachos, where the Rambam is going through the different categories of brachos. We know that there's three categories of brachos. There are birchos ha-mitzvah, blessing we make upon fulfillment of mitzvos, blessings of shevach v'hoda, of gratitude to Hashem, and also blessings on eating, birchos ha-nen. Those are the three categories of brachos. We know that one is not allowed to eat before they make a bracha, because the Gemara in Brachos says on Lamed Hey that if anyone eats without making a bracha, it's ki'ilu mal, as if you've taken from Hashem, meaning that I need to first recognize where the food is coming from before I can eat it. Says the Nod Behuda, that's the same thing for Birchas HaMitzvos as well, the blessings we make upon fulfillment of mitzvos. I make a bracha before I do the mitzvah in order to focus me as to what it is that I'm doing, why I'm doing it, that I'm engaging in a mitzvah, that this is a commandment of God, it's a mitzvah Hashem. And for all of those reasons, I'm now doing this mitzvah. By making the bracha, it focuses me in that kind of way. The Rambam over there writes that when it comes to mitzvah between people, mitzvah ben adam l'chavero, there's no brachos we make on mitzvah ben adam l'chavero. Mitzvah between people, it's interpersonal mitzvahs, no brachos. Now, that's different than the Rashba. Rashba had to go through every one to explain why each one. He has a whole list explaining why each mitzvah doesn't get its own bracha. The Rambam has this general principle, though, where he writes that mitzvos ben adam l'chavero, mitzvos between people, don't have their own bracha. Rabbi Soloveitchik, as Zatzal explained, he said that he explained the Rambam basically saying that because if a person were to make a bracha before they did an interpersonal mitzvah, it would objectify the recipient of that mitzvah, the beneficiary of the mitzvah. Objectify them, right? Like Dee was saying, like make them feel bad, right? The way the Rav Hirsch said it is that if you make a bracha before doing a mitzvah that's, you know, in front of, sorry, I'm about to go visit somebody who's sick. I walk into their room and right before I'm about to sit down, I make a bracha. Baruch atah Hashem Elokeinu Melech Haolam Asher Gishamnu Sod Tzvanu Levaker Esacholim. I'm going to make them feel like an apple. Right? I'm about to like take a bite out of them, right? Like it objectifies them, make them feel like an apple, make them feel like an esrog, make them feel like a lulav. It just objectifies the person. And so therefore, you could also give that answer for the Manos HaLevi, why it is we don't make a bracha on Shalach Manos, because again, it would just objectify people. And therefore, we wouldn't make a bracha in those scenarios. This also relates to, but this is a much longer discussion, so we'll just mention it briefly, is the Rav Tzvi Beis HaFrank in the Har Tzvi, he was the predecessor of Rav Zsolti Zatzal. Rav Zsolti was the chief rabbi of Yerushalayim. Tzvi Beis HaFrank was the chief rabbi of Yerushalayim before Rav Zsolti. And he has a tshuva, a responsa in his Sefer Har Tzvi, where he talked about the scenario of, let's say you have somebody that lives in, Beit Shemesh, that wants to send Mishloach Manos to somebody that lives in Yerushalayim. Now, person living in Yerushalayim celebrates Purim on the 15th. The person in Beit Shemesh is celebrating Purim tomorrow on the 14th. Right? It could be it's already Purim in Eretz Yisrael right now. So they're celebrating Purim right now. All right, they're not celebrating Purim on the 15th. Can I fulfill my mitzvah by selling Mishloach Manos to the recipient who's going to receive it on their Purim in Yerushalayim? So Rav Tzvi Beis HaFrank says that this is related to the same discussion, because he wants to frame the discussion of the Manas Halevi and the Trumas Adeshen of that, is it to build camaraderie or is it to facilitate food? Is that, is Mishloach Mano recipient focused, which is like the Trumas Adeshen, that it's to facilitate food for the Suuda, meaning it's about their Suuda, it's about their meal. If it's about their meal, so I need to send something that is going to facilitate food for their Suuda. So as long as they sent it on my Purim, and the recipient does with it whatever they want on their Purim, so then I fulfill the mitzvah, even though it's a day later. That's the piece of Frank wants to say according to Shurim Sedeshan. But if you say according to the Manas Halevi, it's not recipient focused, but rather it's sender focused, meaning that I have a responsibility today to build closer relationships between myself and other members of Klal Yisrael. And it needs to all happen today. And therefore, if it got there a day later, you wouldn't fulfill your mitzvah. As we mentioned before, we try and be machmir about all of these different questions. We want to make sure that we fulfill this mitzvah of Mishloach Manos the best way possible, because it has a similar status to being like a Deoraisa. And I'll just mention that our Rebbe Rav Hirsch would always tell us that the best way to fulfill the mitzvah of Mishloach Manos is that, to fulfill all the different opinions, is, oh, another one. We didn't mention another practical implication, that according to some Rishonim, that you should try and have an intermediary deliver your Shalach Manos. Have someone, like what we do at the shul, we have people pick up baskets and deliver them, right? Because the more people you get involved, the better. That's like a Manos Halevi approach, to build camaraderie. According to Jerusalem Sedeshin, does it really matter? Not really, because it's just about facilitating food. Again, there's a number of other Mishloach Manos, right? But that's right. Meaning, if you take that approach that you want to get more people involved, like Mr. Reese is saying, that reads more technically with the words of Mishloach means to send, as opposed to no same, right? Just giving, right? Or yitain, matanos ish l're'ehu. It says specifically Mishloach, which means to send, that means through an intermediary. So the way Rav Hirsch said the best way to fulfill Shalach Manos, according to all the opinions, is that you get a basket and you put salami and challah roll and a bottle of wine. These are foods that you can use to have a su'uda. And you go to somebody that you don't really know so well, and you give them this basket of challah, salami, and a bottle of wine. And then by doing so, you are fulfilling the mitzvah in the best way possible, creating a new camaraderie in Klal Yisrael. He said that some of his closest friends he made on Purim morning, when he would go to another floor in the dormitory when he was in college, go to another floor of the dormitory when he was in yeshiva, and he'd knock on some random person's door that he didn't know, and he'd hand them a salami, a challah, and a bottle of wine on Purim. Some of the closest friends he ever made. Anyway, the person opened the door and say, "Who are you and what is this?" He said, "I want to wish you happy Purim. This is a, you know, like that. That's this is what we're trying to accomplish on Purim. This is what we're trying to accomplish on Purim." Okay, very good. Wish everybody an easy, meaningful, and simchadik fast, and that we should be able to fulfill all the mitzvahs of the day of Purim. Take the lessons of the day of Purim. That tefillah really works. Mesiras Nefesh is integral to Klal Yisrael's redemption, and that we need to build more simcha in our lives on the day of Purim, that hopefully will bring us to the greatest simcha of all that we experience by Yom Tov Mashiach. We'll stop here.
Be a Omer.
Yeah.